Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On board today, Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Ben.
Thank you for coming into our Ames studio. Also with us, Megan Goldberg, assistant professor of American politics at Cornell College in Mount Vernon. Hi, Megan.
Hey, Ben. Great to be here.
Great to have you with us and join our discussion. I hope you have this number noted, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Later in the hour, what's left on the agenda at the Iowa State House? We're in the second funnel week. Governor Reynolds having a bit of a slip in terms of approval in a new Iowa poll. We'll ask Megan and Jim about the significance of that. Mike Pence, we heard in our news here in Iowa, three stops today. This comes as a judge rules that the former vice president must testify to a January 6th grand jury. Also, we'll go abroad, relying on Jim's foreign policy expertise, and explore what's been happening in Israel. That's quite dramatic. Is democracy at risk in Israel? That's still to come. Let's address this first of all. We have so many times addressed this on our Politics Day, and always seem to end up in the same place of powerlessness, it seems. And yesterday, President Biden declared himself powerless to respond to the scourge of gun violence in our country, you know, one day after an assailant killed six people, including three children, at a school in Nashville. His quote, "I have gone the full extent of my executive authority to do on my own anything about guns." President Biden telling reporters who were asking questions about what actions he could take to prevent mass shootings. Let's hear a bit of audio before we hear from Jim and Megan. This is the Senate chaplain, Barry C. Black's morning prayer yesterday, calling for action on the Senate floor, calling lawmakers to take action following that latest shooting.
Lord, when babies die at a church school, it is time for us to move beyond thoughts and prayers. Remind our lawmakers of the words of the British statesman Edmund Burke: all that is necessary for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing.
And to hear an apparent expression of powerlessness, here is a U.S. Representative Tim Burchett, Republican from Tennessee, telling reporters there's nothing really lawmakers can do to reduce gun violence. Listen to this.
I don't see any real role that we could do other than mess things up, honestly, because of the situation. It's like I said, I don't think a criminal's going to stop from guns. You know, you can print them out on the computer now, 3D printing, and there's really, I don't think you're going to stop the gun violence. I think you've got to change people's hearts.
Okay, U.S. Representative Tim Burchett of Tennessee. Megan, let's start off with quite a dramatic or just a remarkable statement. There is no role he sees except to mess things up. What do you make of that, and also the remarkably blunt admission by President Biden conceding his powerlessness here at this point?
Yeah, you know, so sort of first on the note of the congressman from Tennessee, I think he's part of this movement among some members of Congress on the right and sort of calling for this revival of Christianity in the U.S. as a solution to gun violence. He was part of a small group of legislators who sort of gathered in the rotunda. I think Lauren Boebert was there for like a worship service concert. And there's sort of, and you see this now, I think, more and more frequently, it sort of almost evolved from sort of the discussion around, you know, maybe like 3 or 4 years ago, the need to address mental health. And it's sort of called instead for this like new morality, a revival of Christianity. And that this is about changing hearts,
mm-hmm.
And not about like policy solutions to prevent the flow of guns into hands. And, you know, so I think that there are lots of policy solutions, certainly. I think it's also notable, and you know, obviously we can't listen to everything he said, but I think he follows one of those comments by remarking that he actually homeschools his children. And so that sort of protects them, which again, it sort of like is aligned with this whole approach to politics that we're seeing emerge on the right that's connected to Christian nationalism and this idea that you know, sort of like removing yourself and your children to protect them sort of from state influence. And, you know, obviously not everyone can homeschool their children for many, many reasons. There's lots of reasons that, you know, public school is really important, obviously. So I think that, you know, he and it's also interesting to sort of in contrast with Biden, because I think Biden has a very fair point that there are limits to executive authority on this. And I know lots of people were frustrated by those comments yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
But the reliance on the president to make policy is really not in line with the power that the president actually has. And so every time the president acts, has to act in this because of congressional inaction. It's because Congress is not able to do something when really the power of legislation is supposed to, by design, lie with Congress.
Yeah, and it's also we have to remind ourselves that the U.S. is by far has the most gun violence deaths, so over 40,000 per year, and you know. Countries, even Canada, if you want to talk about a North American country, does not come close to the number of gun deaths. Jim McCormick, your take on this latest tragedy and the politics that surround it.
Well, I think the president's position is that, you know, he has tried in terms of kind of gun control, and given the polarization within the society here and within the Congress, that is not a solution. I'm not entirely convinced that the president, you know, he has the bully pulpit and he has the power to persuade. And I think that, you know, the leadership there and speaking out rather forcefully and rather continuously will have some dampening effect, or I hope would have some dampening effect. But I think really the efforts to get at this violence involve civil society here and civil society groups. I don't think it's going to be done with a government solution here. It really does have to have some grassroots kind of initiative here. Maybe it has to be taken up in presidential and congressional campaigns, but I don't see it as legislative outcomes. It's more in terms of a kind of a moral outcome that politicians across the spectrum would agree upon, and they don't agree upon gun control apparently, but they certainly could agree on taking some actions in terms of mental health, for example, and moving in that direction and supporting you know the civil society groups that are making an effort to try to address this.
Here's
there's no easy solution to this. Let's be realistic about this.
One of our listeners in Cedar Rapids, David, writing this, and Megan, if you can respond, give us your reaction to this. He writes, in reference to the uniquely American problem of mass casualty events, we need a news embargo on these local stories. The stories are fear-driven clickbait and add nothing to local or national policy. Journalists have a duty to de-emphasize the names of perpetrators, but also to embargo the events themselves. Otherwise, he writes, there will be copycat after copycat. That's a solution that takes my breath away, Megan. That we not report on these. Wow.
You know, so I think in some cases, what the U.S. has is a problem with the cat being out of the bag in many ways, right? Like these shootings increased, not just with, you know, I know lots of people point to the assault weapons ban ending, but also there, I mean, in many ways, right? All of these are copycats of Columbine, which happened when I was in school. And so it's sort of like, and granted, right, other countries have not sort of seen these copycats. So it also is the availability of weapons. But I think we also have this problem, you know, I was looking at some statistic that compared to, the, you know, how many sort of assault weapons were out in the wild right before the assault weapons ban in the 90s is just like it's not comparable to the scale of those weapons out, you know, in the wild today. And so, you know, and I think that there is a fair concern with how do you reduce the number of weapons that currently exist in society, because it's astronomically huge in the U.S. Mm-hmm. You know, the guns per capita here is higher than I think almost anywhere else. But, you know, in a lot of cases, I think some of these, the perpetrators of these events are acquiring new ones. And so that's, you know, I think that sometimes we're making perfect the enemy of the good here, where you could have some reduction by making these less, you know, easy to obtain. But I think too, you know, I think that it's really hard to embargo local news like this. I just like can't imagine the realistic way for this to happen in a sort of digital age. And I know news embargoes happen, but that's sort of a different scenario when you don't have hundreds of kids with cell phones in a lockdown. So, you know, a middle school lockdown happened in Indiana, and I heard about it before I heard about it on the news.
Yeah.
Because information travels fast.
Not to speak of the journalistic ethics that would be involved in just not reporting
right.
a mass casualty situation. It's hard for me to understand that. Let's go very quickly to our caller, Tom in Des Moines. We have just about a minute or so before we go to break. Tom, can you make it quick? Welcome.
Sure, yes, long-time listener, sometimes caller. The legal system is precisely the problem, so the lawmaker in Tennessee has it wrong. We need to change the legal system of how we interpret gun laws. Take this hypothetical, a person...
Quickly, Tom, please.
Yes, a person who's a stranger, we see him in the public with gun, and our reaction is not, this is a person who's there to protect us, he's there to... perhaps be a potential mass murderer. But this reaction undercuts the whole attitude of the gun culture. And so we have to look at the things this way. We have to understand that this is where we're heading.
Tom in Des Moines, thank you for your input. We have to go to break now. Back with more of our Politics Wednesday edition. Megan Goldberg with us of Cornell College and Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. When we come back, we're going to move on to this second funnel week of the Iowa legislature, what lawmakers are still considering. You can join our conversation. We've moved on from gun violence. We have a number of other topics to cover. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back with more of our Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Megan Goldberg of Cornell College, our two political analysts, tackling some of the high-profile political news, national level, international. We'll go a little bit later to talk about Israel, but let's go to state politics for now. Governor Kim Reynolds signed two major pieces of legislation last week. That was the transgender kids in Iowa now legally banned from starting gender-affirming medical treatments and from using school bathrooms that align with their gender identity. Under Iowa's new laws, lawmakers at the State House coming up to another legislative deadline at the end of this week. This is the so-called second funnel deadline, either pushing bills forward or dropping them for the session. Monday on this program, we'll discuss in depth which bills survived the second funnel this week, which are dead for this session. Some bills that lawmakers are still considering: changes to eligibility requirements for SNAP and Medicaid, a bill that would change what the state auditor is able to access during investigations, limits to public land expansion. We had a big conversation about that on this program earlier this week. New restrictions on handheld phone use while driving still being debated, and also the House and Senate still having slightly different education bills that would restrict what books can be in school libraries and ban teaching about gender identity and sexual education. Megan, I'd like to go to you first on this. What are you watching at this point in this incredibly ambitious and polarizing session while the GOP is in the majority?
Yeah, I mean, so I'm sort of watching to see, you know, how Reynolds is weighing her legislative priorities, the remaining ones, with sort of the political capital she has left. You know, one thing I'm watching that I'm trying to now remember in that list, if you've already mentioned it, is sort of the progression of pipeline legislation with the carbon capture pipelines. I know last week the House passed a somewhat controversial solution on a bipartisan vote, I believe, that would require 90% of people who are affected by it to sell before the companies could use eminent domain. And the idea was this would put some power back into the hands sort of collectively of the people affected. But I think as of this morning, the Senate is not advancing that.
Yeah, that's what I've heard too. Yep.
And so the other thing, you know, I think overall I'm sort of watching is not just, you know, there's been a ton of education policy. There's a ton of rollbacks of sort of public assistant programs. That's all sort of expected. The thing that I'm really watching, I think, are these institutional changes to the balance of power sort of inside the executive branch, but between the executive branch and the legislature, or between the state government and local governments, that are sort of clearly an attempt to increase the power of Republicans in the state, particularly in the executive branch. So you already mentioned limiting the power of the state auditor, that basically any audit sort of has to be with the permission of whatever agency is being audited, that they could have more control over what files they provide. And that's, you know, that's a risky move, I think, because for a lot of people, at least people who are really invested in state politics, Rob Sand does have a lot of approval sort of on both sides of the aisle, and also good government and anti-corruption are all sort of things that most people like. And so that's a little risky. I think the other sort of thing I'm looking at is there's some legislation that they've been considering adjusting county supervisor elections, targeting Democratic counties in particular, that would affect the way they do elections. It's not clear to me that that would actually pay off for Republicans, you know, but it's sort of another sort of step in sort of exerting Republican power over institutional rules in a way they think will benefit them in the future.
Mm-hmm. Jim, your thoughts?
Well, she's covered a lot of the different issues there. I think the auditor's bill will be quite interesting to see if that really that change really comes about. I mean, the bill, as I understand it, would require that if there's an audit, that both parties would have to agree on what would be part of that audit. And Auditor Sands, of course, has pushed back rather strongly on that, saying that they're already following a standard governmental procedures in terms of the audit. So I think that is really a bit of a power play. I would be surprised if there's not something done on the eminent domain issue, though. I know that you said that it's kind of pushed back, but, you know, that actually has, you know, some kind of considerable consequences, it seems to me, for agriculture in this state, as well as for, you know, climate change here. One of the issues that have not been mentioned, and I'm interested to see, because I did hear some discussion of it just today, is over property tax relief. You know, this has been a property tax debate that's been going on for several years. I was going to say decades, but certainly for years. And there is still some, I suppose, prospect, you know, particularly if they tie it into the budget, because that doesn't necessarily require the, you know, the funnel limitations of getting it passed in both chambers in one of the committees. So it'll be interesting to see if the property tax debate comes about here. I think on the some of the classroom instruction and gender discussion, sexual orientation discussion, it sounds like that there is still a considerable debate on that and in terms of different versions here. So I'm not sure where that ends up in terms of really getting passed. I would not be surprised, finally, in terms of the handheld devices while driving. Let me just say I favor that. Let me just be clear about that.
As do most Iowans polls.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. So I think that that is something that should really clear the legislature and be signed into law. One final thing, I think Megan makes an interesting point about the reorganization bill, of course, which was signed into law, I guess, last week. Moving from 37 departments down to, I think it's 17, if memory serves me correctly, 15, I guess, excuse me. And I think that that's a major power play in terms of what the implications of that are in terms of the size of government. Now, the immediate response was that there'll be no loss of positions and employees, but undoubtedly there'll be attrition over time, and whether those would be replaced, I think, is really the question here. And that sort of goes along with the legislature's, at least a majority legislature, idea of trying to trim back Iowa government. So that's another thing that I think to take a look at here.
Let's tie what you've both commented on into a recent Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll from a few days ago showing Governor Reynolds' approval rating slipping, the share of Iowans who approve of her job performance fallen 3 percentage points from 53% in October of last year to 50% today. At the same time, the share of those who disapprove of it is up 4 percentage points from 42% last year to 46% today. We remind ourselves, Governor Reynolds had an easy re-election last fall, defeating challenger Deidre Dejere by nearly 19 points. She had 58% of the vote. Megan, what are your thoughts here? I mean, this is a slight decrease. Perhaps you could explain most of it or all of it by a margin of error in the poll. Or are there any signs here that perhaps the GOP, Governor Reynolds, may be overreaching, in some cases going beyond what her supporters, those who went to the ballot for her, would like?
Yeah, you know, so I don't want to make too much of a 3 percentage point decline over that time period. You would expect that too, especially given that not a lot was really, you know, happening. She had talking about, I think the previous poll was in like October of 2022. And so at that time, like, we've all heard from Reynolds' campaign over and over again about positive things, but we haven't, you know, it's been a minute since the legislature has adjourned. So we've all sort of like collectively distanced ourselves from what happened. And now, you know, she's sort of in the thick of it, signing laws and sort of pursuing her legislative agenda. But I do think that the, you know, there are places where if you look at public opinion on specific issues in Iowa and the laws have been passed, there's a major indication that laws are out of step with the public in Iowa. And, you know, I don't want to attribute too much of the slip to that at the moment, but I think we could see the negative impact of sort of being out of step as we go. As, you know, if you think about some of these laws that have passed, like, people haven't felt the impact of them yet in many ways. And so if you're thinking about book bans, like, maybe nothing's happened in your school district, but maybe, you know, next fall, you know, your kids' curriculum will be impacted. And, you know, especially if we talk about bans on social emotional learning and things like that, you're going to see a change in what your child is learning, you know, if you're a parent. And that's when you might, you know, sort of shift your approval of sort of what's happening in the state, if you think the state's in the right direction, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Jim, do you agree with that analysis?
Yeah, I largely agree with that. I think it's, you know, I think it's really a lot of margin of error here, to be honest. But even in terms of the discussion of it, you know, you have, over time, when you govern, you have the coalition of minorities that always find something that you're not doing that they want you to do, or that they find something they disagree with. And so I think, you know, what Megan's referring to is that over time, you know, this kind of coalition of minorities will, in fact, you know, maybe move in the direction of opposing you. I noticed in on the write-up of one of the people that actually had voted for Reynolds said, well, she really wasn't happy with the school choice decision, but overall she thought she was doing a good job. So I mean, I think that's the kind of change that you might get in terms of a few people here. The other thing to keep in mind is you got to have somebody who really is willing and able and demonstrably able to oppose the sitting governor. And I think, you know, if I might say so, one of the things the Democrats have had is that they, you know, they don't have that kind of figure that has that state presence here.
Mm-hmm. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Megan Goldberg of Cornell College. Join us, 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Former Vice President Mike Pence in Iowa today. We heard in our news, Urbandale, I think this morning, then on to Cedar Rapids, ending up in Coralville. Let's talk about this aspect, though, of the former Vice President. We learned this week he'll have to testify in a January 6th investigation grand jury, judge ruling that he'll have to answer some questions about Donald Trump's attempts to overturn the 2020 election results. Let's discuss this. Jim, you first on this. The significance of this court ruling, I'm wondering, you know, does it mean that Mike Pence will have to testify? Can he take the fifth? Are there a limit to the type of questions he will have to answer?
Apparently, the judge's ruling was that he'll have to testify, but that if there were some when he was really, in charge of the Senate and so on, that he would not have to testify. And so the judge had some ambiguity in terms of the decision that was ultimately handed down. One of the things that was really squashed was the executive privilege that the Trump administration or President Trump tried to utilize here to stop Pence from testifying at all. In an ironic way, actually, this might be actually beneficial, particularly to Pence, especially if he's going to be a presidential campaign, which seems to be without a formal declaration, pretty self-evident.
Or he just likes coming to Iowa, Jim.
Right. Yeah. He wants to come to the Amanas and have a good meal, for example, or whatever. So in any event, I think that this helps him in the sense that, you know, he's talked about, you know, if he were to get into the race, he wants to bring dignity back to the presidency and so on, and wants to have a different kind of leadership. And so in some ways, this, yes, he's got to testify in terms of some of the apparently some of the conversations that he had with the president, President Trump. But also, I think that his role there is sort of amplified in terms of the dignity that he brought to the Senate and the whole decision making over, approving the election outcome. So I don't think it is quite as negative a decision as some might portray it here for Mr. Pence.
Yeah. Megan, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, so I think this is really interesting in light of some of the comments that Trump has actually made on his visits to Iowa, when he was in, Davenport, sort of blaming Pence for January 6th, sort of saying, you know, if Pence had just done what I wanted him to, which was send the votes back to state legislatures and reject them, then none of this would have happened. So I think that, you know, Jim is right that it gives Pence this opportunity. And I think he has to toe sort of a thin line of sort of bringing dignity back or like, you know, following the existing procedures, emphasizing rule of law here. It's too late. Like Trump is already, you know, attacking him. And so there's no sort of like avoiding being one of Trump's targets, I think. But I think he has to toe this line of still sort of courting some of the Republican tendencies to be upset about Trump being potentially legal trouble for all of this. And we sort of saw that on one of Pence's visits where he says the idea of indicting a former president is troubling, but also no one is above the law. And so I think that this testimony might be a challenge to sort of toe that line, depending on, you know, how specific the questioning gets. And to what degree he can sort of toe that line and try to balance these competing interests.
Now, away from the politics, Megan, though, do you think there are questions that his testimony might answer things about January 6th that he and perhaps only he in his conversations he will testify to about his with Donald Trump that we may have answered?
You know, I think that's certainly possible. I know, now I've like lost all sense of time. At one point, we sort of heard some, maybe it was from a book, some revelations about what was going on with Pence sort of that day. And there were some, you know, where he mentioned that he was supposed to get into a car and Secret Service was asking him to get in the car. And he said, I'm not getting in that car. And, you know, I think there's still maybe some question marks again about what exactly, you know, Trump was saying to him, what he was hearing from inside the Trump camp versus his own people. And so I think that there's a possibility it could shed some light on that. I don't know how much of it will have legal ramifications. But I think, you know, the idea of all of these hearings and testimonies to get a sense of what was going on behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm. We have to take a short break. We'll be back with more from Megan Goldberg of Cornell College, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of our program. And when we come back, I want to talk about former President Trump's rhetoric, insightful rhetoric, I guess you could say. His quote, that charges his indictment, which we've had in the news, pending, evidently coming, could mean death and destruction. That was from his social media platform. I want to get the comments from our analysts on that. We'll hear a little bit from his Waco, Texas rally on the weekend. When we return, it's River to River from IPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Back with more of our Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from IPR News. Ben Kiefer with Megan Goldberg of Cornell College, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, lending us their analysis of some of the most high-profile political news on our landscape. Democratic lawmakers calling out former President Trump for rhetoric against federal officials and prosecutors. We've been following the story of the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg, heading an investigation that could lead to charges and indictment against Trump. This is the Stormy Daniels affair. Late last week, the former president warned on his Truth social platform that charges could mean, quote, death and destruction. That post later deleted. The former president shared an image of himself with a baseball bat next to the Manhattan District Attorney, Bragg. Bragg has since then received death threats, including an envelope with white powder in it. The president, former president, I should say, on the weekend in Waco, Texas, with crowds of supporters there. Waco, significance from 1993, of course, that standoff between federal agents there and a religious cult leading to 86 deaths. A new poll showing Donald Trump has convinced roughly 4 in 10 Americans he is the victim of a witch hunt in these investigations. Jim, your take on all of this, that was a PBS NewsHour NPR Morris poll. What do you make of this and the rhetoric that we've heard from the former president?
Well, the rhetoric is really over the top, it seems to me, and really unacceptable in terms of a political campaign. And the problem is for Trump is that it's not going to gain him any more support. It might activate his base support, but it doesn't get anybody beyond that. With this kind of discussion descriptions here. Because all it does is to raise the issue is when he was in the White House, and all of the kind of rhetoric that he used. And that really has turned off a lot of people here. And so not only is it, damaging in terms of the sort of the culture of the U.S., but in a real political sense, it does him no good. And, the imagery of a baseball bat against the D.A. of Manhattan here, is even more so makes this point. So I don't know how he imagines that this really helps him beyond the 4 in 10 that you talk about that will embrace him. you can't win elections with 4 in 10, it seems to me. And that I think is, aside from the damage that it does to the political culture within the U.S., in a real political sense, it is just, undermines any kind of broader appeal that he might be trying to cultivate here.
And there seems to be backing in that latest PBS NewsHour NPR poll for what you're saying there, Jim. I didn't mention this, but I will now because it dovetails perfectly with what you're saying. In that poll, 3/4 of Republicans would like to see Donald Trump be president again, but independent voters, nearly two-thirds of them do not want him. And that's what you're talking about, right? This is a dilemma.
It really is. I mean, you've got to win elections with independents.
Yeah.
There's going to be no appeal. I mean, and all of, we know from past election, I mean, that's where the soft spot has been in terms of independence here. And so I don't know why there is not really more of a focus on, instead of these kind of general statements about I'm going to improve the economy, I'm going to end the Ukraine war in 24 hours or whatever, that they're really set down not in detail. Certainly, you don't want to get too down far in the weeds, but you gotta really say what you're going to do in terms of the kind of actions that you might take in terms of addressing the economic kind of situations here, or restoring, put it to slightly differently, the respect for law and order in the society.
Megan Goldberg, I want to play a little excerpt from the former president's rally in Waco, Texas, this past weekend. See if you agree with some historians. So this is a small snippet of it, but this is perhaps a good example. Some historians saying that Trump's rhetoric at that Waco rally containing dog whistles to white nationalists. Here are some of his comments on this past Saturday.
We will build new monuments to our great American heroes. We won't tear them down. We'll build them up. Clean out homeless camps from our inner cities. Get rid of ugly buildings that are hurting those cities and other places. And return to the magnificent classical style of Western civilization. We will support baby bonuses, so many people like that, for the new baby boom that will be coming. We need babies.
I don't know how much of the entire speech you heard, Megan, but give us your read.
Yeah, so I mean, I would say certainly, especially in that clip. And, I had pulled a couple quotes from his speech, where he says things like, I am your warrior, I am your justice. And it's a lot of sort of white nationalism and a lot of like white Christian nationalism in a lot of ways, too. He sort of, as this all was going on, either I think following his visit, he shared on Truth Social an AI-generated image of him praying. And it's really like apocalyptic in the way he sort of paints this like struggle between Democrats and himself. But I also think, that the connection to Waco, that he went to Waco first, is really mm-hmm. important, with the connections to, obviously, it was on the anniversary as well. And the way that so many far right sort of extremist groups, that's sort of like a, I don't know what I want to call it, a route that they sort of point back to.
Right. And Megan, at this rally, I don't know if you heard this part, but connecting Waco, what happened there in 1993 with January 6th, the rally included a recording of our national anthem sung by people
yes.
incarcerated for rioting on January 6th.
Yeah. So I think that it's the sort of like, connection here, I think, is that Trump is sort of pointing to himself and all of his followers as this, like, target of federal overreach, in the same way that, the Branch Davidians were in the 90s. And certainly the people sort of still affiliated with that group see it that way. And lots of sort of far right groups also see that connection as well. And so, yeah, I think that absolutely it's sort of trying to make these connections. And even if you can't find anything, explicitly talking about sort of white supremacy or whiteness, the undertones are all like very much present throughout this whole thing. If you start to think about like who is Trump sort of painting as the bad guys here, the enemies? And, it's going to be people who aren't sort of in this very mainstream, traditional sort of groups that are associated with the Republican Party, but especially, sort of the base of the Republican Party that supports Trump.
Mm-hmm. On our Politics Wednesday, for the remaining approximately 10 minutes, I wanted to focus on geopolitics. And Jim, you have a lot of many decades of foreign policy expertise. That doesn't preclude Megan from jumping in. Please do, Megan. I know you have a lot of things to say, perhaps about the domestic repercussions of some of these stories. Let's talk about Israel. What a fascinating story there. Huge protests for weeks in Israel over a planned judicial overhaul. Today, Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel responding to sharp criticism from our president over his government's judicial overhaul plan. Quote from the Israeli Prime Minister in a statement posted on Twitter, "I have known President Biden for over 40 years, and I appreciate his longstanding commitment to Israel," but then adding on Twitter, "Israel is a sovereign country which makes its decisions based on the will of its people, not on pressures from abroad, including from the best of friends." Netanyahu's remarks there coming after President Biden telling reporters he was, quote, very concerned about events in Israel. First of all, Jim, help us understand what is causing the furor among so many in Israel.
Well, Netanyahu's coalition of governing, you know, it comes from the right side in the Israeli and religious parties within Israel. And so he's very much beholden to them. He also been, of course, have been under indictment for corruption charges. And the real figure that has stimulated this kind of response among the Israeli public is that Netanyahu is proposing that, in fact, and you think of it in terms of the American context, that the courts would not have a judicial review over legislation that is passed by the Knesset or by the parliament, by the Israeli parliament here. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in effect, the Supreme Court in Israel would become powerless. The other component of this in terms of the proposal is that instead there's a selection committee to put judges, you know, on the court and so on. And now under this proposal, basically a majority would come from the government here. So there would be government dominance here. So both of these are part of what President Biden said in terms of the kind of the attack upon democracy here. And of course, the rejoinder by Netanyahu saying that this was an internal matter. But how much of a danger this is to Israeli democracy? I think the response of the Israeli public really recognizes the dangers here. And I think they have already, exercised, sort of the mass public control, if you will, here. Netanyahu, within the past days, within a day or so, has sort of stepped down from this, kind of called for a pause, at least, in considering this legislation until over the Passover is complete, over the Knesset recess and so on. And I noticed just this morning that they've already had a meeting with developed by the president, by the Israeli president Herzog, to call the parties together to discuss how they might change this legislation. The problem is, it seems to me, is that Netanyahu is so dependent upon this coalition of these right-wing parties here, as well as to protecting him from any this kind of corruption indictment. I don't know how much compromise he can really affect here, because he also said today that the legislation is going to be passed here. Mm. So the issue remains, it seems to me, in a stalemated position, and whether that will bring about, you know, yet another the fall of the government and a new election, might be one possible outcome if they're really efforts by Netanyahu to stand strong on this particular bill.
Megan Goldberg, thoughts on protests in Israel and this latest development and its repercussions here on our own politics?
Yeah, I mean, so I think one of the sort of implications I've seen the most is sort of to see what's happening within the Democratic Party, because that's an issue, you know, sort of the role of or the relationship between Israel and the U.S. is sort of a fracture point inside the Democratic Party, especially as more and more we used to call them the squad. I know we still do, but as more and more progressive sort of members are elected to the House. Mm-hmm. And so I know that, you know, I've seen that some sort of liberal leaning but pro-Israel groups have really been lobbying quite hard to their own members to sort of put public pressure to whatever degree they can on the Israeli government and to, you know, sort of push back on the far right and democratic backsliding. Because as that happens, you know, I think they sort of see that as straining the relationship and the support from the Democratic Party for Israel.
Mm-hmm. In the few remaining moments, perhaps we could include some comments from you, especially, Jim, on Taiwan. Next week, we have the Taiwanese president heading to the U.S. I think it's officially been called a stopover, evidently, in reading the news, that the president there expected to meet Speaker Kevin McCarthy there, and then also this tension. What reaction can we expect from Beijing, and why a meeting on American soil between a Taiwanese president and a House Speaker in our country so contentious?
Well, the starting point, of course, is that the PRC, the People's Republic of China, the Chinese government, sees Taiwan as really part of their sovereignty here. And they of course, see this as an effort with this stopover and potential meeting with the Speaker of the House, you know, as an affront to their sovereign control. And of course, President Xi Jinping has said that he wants to have a rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. And part of that rejuvenation is to bring Taiwan back into the fold here. And this, of course, would be an affront. But keep in mind, the United States, yes, it does not have diplomatic relations with Taiwan, but it has the American Institute on Taiwan, which is kind of a euphemism for a diplomatic relationship that's kind of non-official. And there are about 58 countries around the world that have the same kind of relationship that the United States has, not officially diplomatic relations, but they have unofficial ties with Taiwan. And so I think that the Speaker of the House would back down from this meeting, I think that would really show a great deal of weakness. And I hope that Speaker McCarthy does not step back and simply bow to the Chinese on this and in terms of their claim that, you know, this would be a violation of the one China policy here that the United States has proclaimed here back since 1979 here. So I think that this is really, again, a kind of a tension point in terms of the Chinese-American relationship. But I think it's partly that the United States has to really assert itself, its role of having this kind of relationship with Taiwan. And it's going to be a stopover meeting. It's not kind of an official visit. It'll be perhaps just a very short meeting here. So that would be my hope. I think the real meeting is going to be with some of the Central American countries that the Taiwanese president is going to visit.
And I think you would say we could expect Beijing to respond with more large-scale threatening military exercises around the island, Taiwan.
Well, I think that would be one outcome. I think there will be certainly the diplomatic, the sort of the wolf warrior argument that they've used in terms of their yeah. activities. I hope not the demonstrations, but you may be right on that.
We got to go. Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Megan Goldberg, assistant professor of American politics at Cornell College. Today's program produced by Danny Gear with help from Caitlin Troutman. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Take care, and we'll talk with you again tomorrow. Thanks.